Utahns prize hard work and service, and today's guest is proof of that. Speaking to her, you get the feeling you could call her any time of day or night with any favor, and she'd show up, no questions asked. Raised on farms in Richfield and Gunnison, she says she just never saw an alternative way of doing things.
Some of the things that impacted me most in my life were certainly my father and my mother's work ethic. They worked so hard. They were so willing to give their all. And if something extra was added, they just gave more effort. That really was the greatest example, the thing that impacted me the most in my life.
I'm Michelle Welch from Utah Women's Walk, and this is Legacies, a podcast dedicated to preserving the inspiring stories and wisdom of Utah women. Ann Takasaki has served on the Intermountain Healthcare Women's Advisory Board, Community Health Connect Board, American Mothers Association, and as the chair of the American Medical Association Alliance, and on the Latter-day Saint Young Women General Board. She is currently on the board of directors for the organization Big Ocean Women. Henry Unger, a former American Studies student from Utah Valley University, interviewed Ann in 2014.
In 1942, Japan bombed Pearl Harbor. And prior to that, my parents, my grandparents, were living on the West Coast and really trying hard to make a success of themselves. When Pearl Harbor was bombed, they were forced to evacuate their homes. They were given 2 weeks to sell whatever they could sell or to ask a trusted friend to take care of it for them. My dad went to the Santa Anita racetracks in California, and they literally lived in the horse stalls. My mother went to the Oregon County Fairgrounds, and her situation was the same. They stayed in the livestock stalls. She talks about being pushed down the livestock ramps into the fairgrounds. It was really humiliating. And as they entered, they were given a large, long bag and told to go fill it with straw. That was their mattress for the several weeks that they'd stay there. Apparently, there are these areas where they're not really showers. They don't come from overhead. Their water shoots out so that they can wash the animals. So that was actually their shower facility. And they put up curtains all around. It was no privacy. So that was a bitter pill to swallow. Then they put them on these trains, and then my mother from Washington, my father from California, were sent to Heart Mountain, Wyoming, which is at the northern part of Wyoming. The wind blows horizontally, and the dust and the snow just passes before your face horizontally. It is so windy there, and it is really cold. And as they were approaching that area, they had to climb a lot of mountains, and the train would slow down. And at these areas where the train slowed down, there would be Japanese American people who were not interned because they lived far enough inland. They would be standing with blankets and heavy coats, and they would push them through the windows and say, "Take these, you'll need them. You don't know what it's like where you're going." When they got there, there were 120,000 Japanese Americans who were interned. And these camps were large camps, rows and rows of barracks. The outside of the barrack was covered with black tar paper. No brick, certainly, or shingles or siding. It was just this black tar paper. And needless to say, it was cold inside their homes. And that's where they lived for 3 years, which is unbelievable, isn't it? But I have to talk about that, my parents, how they met at camp. They were both Sunday school teachers in the Buddhist church, both faithful, devout Buddhists. And my father and mother courted by walking around the outside of the camp night after night, talking about their goals, their dreams, getting to know one another. That was their courtship. They married in the camp, in one of those units, standing room only, many guests, friends, standing in this unit. The party after the ceremony was at the mess hall, and the friends all donated their ration cards, and they somehow miraculously were able to gather a big banquet for their wedding dinner. From the housing unit to the mess hall was, I don't know how long of a walk it was, but my mother's gardenia corsage was all brown by the time they got to the mess hall because it was so cold. It had been frozen. After the war was over and the treaty was signed, these Japanese American people again were given a hard blow. They had 1 week to leave. And some of them were lucky enough to have had friends who maybe took care of their farm and they were able to go back to their farm or their shop, whatever. But the majority of them had nothing like that. But my father, his wife and children, his father, his sister, brother, many people were able to go to Sigurd, Utah, to a produce farm on the Snow Ranch. Sigurd is tiny. There are only like 360 people. I looked at one camp in Topaz, called Topaz in Delta, Utah, was also dispersed. And so my father and these men went to Delta, and I don't know how they did it, but they brought barracks from Delta to Sigurd, Utah, to the Snow Ranch, and that's where they lived. I always wondered why my house looked so funny, you know, the black tar paper. But it wasn't until recently, my adult years, that I realized that it looked funny because it was a barrack. It was one of those barracks, and that's where I lived when I was born. That was my first home. This farm was located in a beautiful place, nestled next to the red hills of Cedar Ridge. But unfortunately, a strain of the nuclear fallout from the testing in Nevada made its way to our farm and to the exact location where my sister was standing one day. And a little while later, she was at the dentist. The dentist recognized the signs of leukemia in her mouth and told my mother to take her to the doctor. She always wanted a sister. When I was born, my mom woke her up and said, "You have a baby sister." And she said, "A sister?" And then she fell back to sleep. They wouldn't let her in the hospital room, but they would sneak me into the window of the hospital and let her hold me, not for very long because she was very weak. She passed away 6 months after I was born. But she's always been a great influence in my life, even though she wasn't living. My father is very religious and wanted his children to have religion. And so he encouraged us to go to the only church that was there, and that was the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormon Church. And my mother, because she wanted us to behave, she took us every Sunday. The fact that I'm a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, such a miracle to me. What a blessing. My parents didn't join the church till they were like 65, you know, after we had all gone on, well, my brothers had all gone on missions. But when my parents were baptized, this is how they announced it. They sent a Christmas card from Gunnison, Utah to Provo, Utah to their children. How weird is that? So we get this Christmas card and that said, "By the way, if you could be there on December 27th, we're going to be baptized." And to this day, we have Buddhist relatives, Mormon relatives, and then we have another group of Christian relatives who are very faithful Christians. We love each other, and we never let our religion stand in the way of our family love. When my children were baptized, my Buddhist relatives were there. When my Buddhist relatives were buried or had a certain memorial services, we were there. In fact, in 2006, about 30 of us went from America to Japan and met with our Japanese relatives. It was an amazing experience. My brother had purchased kimonos, summer kimonos, which are called yukata, for all of us to wear. And we put our yukata on and we sat with our Japanese relatives and had dinner. It was quite a surreal experience because I remember the teenage, kind of young single adult aged girls dressing me, and the young girls, like 9 or 10 year old girls, sitting on the floor looking up at us, and the grandmas, the obachans, standing in the back kitchen area looking on. These generations of Japanese people whose blood was the same, meeting together and sharing our love and our devotion to one another. It was a beautiful experience. They're so similar to us. Their values are the same. In my uncle's office, the diplomas of all of his children and grandchildren are displayed. He's proud that they were able to gain an education. Religion is the same. They have a butsudan, the family shrine, that clearly fresh food was placed there that morning and every night. And when they took us to the temple, this large new temple, they took us past many rows, several little segments, walked right in, went right to the place, opened up the little gate, pulled out the urn, said, here they are, here's our relatives. Clearly religious people, clearly devout in their religious experience. I'm really proud of that. That impacts me. I want to be like them. My father used to say to me, if I didn't want to go to church on Sunday, when I was on the farm in Richfield, Utah, he'd say, you're a Mormon, aren't you? Yes. Well, then go to church. You know, he expected us to be faithful, devout members of whatever church we belong to.
In your childhood, in those formative years, is there mm-hmm. a person, is there an influential woman, someone you admired that set the course for who you looked up to and who you wanted to emulate?
Well, certainly my mother and my grandmother. Their schooling was, of course, limited. They weren't able to get a college degree, but they did whatever they could. My mother took a course in drafting patterns, and so that's why she could call herself a professional seamstress. And my grandmother and my mother were always reading, you know. And that way they were role models for me. Another role model for me within the church was a woman named Miriam Dastrup. She was someone I feared, actually. The other lady that was a role model for me was a woman named Sybil Warnock. And she taught my mother how to do things like make soap. She'd take the fat from the animals, mix it, boil it, render the grease, mix it with lye, and make soap. She made her own soap. And she did things like can. In those days, you actually got a bushel of peaches. When you bought peaches, it was like a whole bushel. And they were made out of wood with the ribbing around the outside and what you would imagine. She would can 24 bushels of peaches every year. And she would go out herself and kill the sheep and take all of this, whatever you do with sheep. And she did all these things. She was a butcher. She provided for her family. Her husband was out farming, but she did everything else. Nothing was too hard. I always knew that I was different from everybody else because I looked so different. In some ways it was an advantage to me. When I tried out for something, I was usually chosen. And I would give credit to my ethnicity. They chose me because I stood out. I was never bullied, but occasionally I would hear words that I knew were not nice, like Jap or slant eyes or something like that. I grew up in Gunnison, Utah. There were 50, 60 at the most people in my class. We all knew each other very well and we all pretty much liked each other. No matter what, we knew that so-and-so's parents were divorced or that so-and-so's father had passed away. We knew that so-and-so's mother and father were alcoholics. We pretty much knew everything about each other. And so it was a real sense of belonging all through high school. I would say that the time when I felt that my race might be at a disadvantage to me was when I was in college thinking about getting married. I really liked one man, and his parents were dead set against his marrying a Japanese woman. That really hurt my feelings. That was a real disappointment to me. But I think that's probably the main experience that I had with being of different nationality that affected me. That one experience that really did hurt me. I had kind of a bitter pill to swallow in college. Something happened to me that was hard. I was a junior in college, and I had this funny bump on my stomach, and I called my roommates. I said, "You guys, come here. What is this? There's something. What is this?" And they said, "Yeah, there's something there." So I went home to Gunnison to the general doctor there, and Dr. Stewart, and he said, "Well, I think it's a hernia. Come home at Christmas time, and we'll just take care of it." I said, "Okay." So I went, finished the semester out, went down to Gunnison. He went to do the surgery, and he said, "I can't do it yet because it doesn't feel like a hernia." So he took some x-rays and then rescheduled the surgery, and I went in and had the surgery. When I came out of the surgery, he told me that he had to remove both my ovaries. So that was a real blow for me, for my whole family. We were just devastated about that. I went back to Provo. I had a boyfriend at the time, and he was just amazing, just helped me through it. I was in Cougarettes at the time, and just carried on with life. But the thing that was hard was every time I'd get close to someone, I'd have to say, "By the way, I have to let you know that I can't have children." So that night, coming home from Gunnison, was the night that I told Roman, "I'm sorry, it seems like maybe you're thinking seriously about me, but you've got to know this. I can't have children." And he said, "I don't care." Of course he would say that. I'm not thinking about it. But it wasn't a big problem for him. It was a big problem for a couple of the young men that I dated. And in fact, the reason that we broke up. But for Roman, it wasn't. And shortly after that, he proposed. And so as soon as we were married, we applied for adoption. I have this amazing friend named Claudia Hyatt Rowley. She was my Cougarette advisor. And she knew my situation. And as soon as we got married, she went to the LDS services for me. And when we got the phone call, the timing was just perfect. We'd been married for 3 years, and the sister on the phone said, "We have your baby for you." I said, "What?" She called me at work. I'm like, "Really? Can I call you back?" So I called my husband. We called him back and said, "Sure." There was someone coming from Hawaii on an airplane, and they would bring our son to us. And so we picked up this little precious baby at the LDS Social Services office, and it was so, so beautiful and such a blessing to know that Heavenly Father would just take care of things for us. We, of course, had such love and such concern for the birth mother, considering what she was feeling and how hard a decision this was to allow us to adopt her child. It was a very emotional experience, but was such a happy time. He was so cute. 6 months later, I was in Gunnison, and Brother Miles Jensen, who also worked for the Social Services Department of the church, said to me at church, he said, "There's a baby girl in the system." I said, "What?" He says, yeah, Japanese baby girl is in the system. And I thought, wow. But I knew that we weren't eligible because you can't apply for another child for 2 years. I thought, at that, when he said that, the moment he said that, I knew that child was our child. And so I went home and I just thought about it all day long, and finally I called the Salt Lake office and I said, you know, I heard that there's a Japanese baby girl that's being placed for adoption. They said, yes, but you're not eligible. I said, but what if I feel like the baby is ours? And I said, well, you know, we're very prayerful in our decisions and we'll take that into consideration and we'll get back to you. So as it turns out, they felt the same way. I was working at a computer software company called Evans & Sutherland, a very technical company, and I was their media support person. Previous to that, I had been a producer of commercials. And so I had quite a bit of media skill. So I got this job at Evans & Sutherland right next to student housing at University of Utah, so it was perfect. But I quit that job and I said to my bosses, if you need me for anything, let me know.
That is quite a jump between young married motherhood and your service with the General Young Women's Board. What are some of the events that led to that? And then if you could just touch on that experience, what that experience was like.
I think it was just, to be quite honest, connections with friends, good people that I've worked with throughout the years.
What are some highlights that you've taken from your service on the board?
I don't know if you know this, but it's really hard to get things accomplished in the church. It's really hard. A lot of what we did was writing, and so we'd have to find time in the morning or late at night to do the reading and the studying required to do the writing. So it was often, you know, up at 4, to bed at 11 or 12. It was many days like that. But it was fun.
It was
really fun. And so we didn't mind it. The curriculum committee especially, their task was really heavy. And they put many, many hours into refining their drafts to be submitted in hopes of approval. And that process went over and over and over again. It's not like you can just write the curriculum and say, here it is. You write it, you give it to somebody, they look at it, they give it to somebody, they look at it, you know, you just hope and pray that your work has been good enough or that someone down the line will like it. And often it's not accepted. And then you just have to just do it all over again. So the fact that curriculum was actually adopted by the church is pretty remarkable.
The maxim that you shared, hard work, education, produce benefits, what are some of the models or maxims or words that have held you through life?
One of them actually is from the Doctrine and Covenants. There is a law irrevocably decreed before the foundations of the world upon which all blessings are predicated. And when you receive any blessings from God, it's upon obedience to that law upon which it's predicated. I think that is a maxim for me. It's a law. You know, that you can't expect something for nothing. That you have to put forth the required work to reap the benefits. So reap and sow, I guess that would be the same maxim, but certainly, that has been a maxim for me. Another thing that I've always been taught is to be generous. No matter what you have, you always have enough to give. My father always taught us that. No matter what I have, I always have enough to give. Some people don't see themselves as able to give anything. It's not true. We're all able to give, and we need to be generous in what we give. It might be our time, and it might be our emotional support, or it might be money.
The last question that I have is just in reference to that beautiful moment that you shared about visiting your family in Japan and having the children watching as the young women helped you dress, as the women generations removed from you watching the entire scene take forth. It's a beautiful moment, and I think it speaks to a larger theme. What is the legacy that you're going to hope to pass on as the baton is passed to yet another generation?
It's interesting. You know, we think about that a lot in our family. Because I'm talking about our extended family, my father's brothers and sisters, who are my aunts and uncles, their children, my cousins, our children, and our grandchildren. We are a strong family, and we meet together often. If members of our family feel that they belong, they're able to accomplish great things. As members of God's family feel like they belong to God's family, that's who they really are, they're able to accomplish great things. So I guess that's part of the legacy that I'm hoping will continue on, a legacy of that they belong to a wonderful family on this earth, the Inoue family, and the legacy that they belong to a wonderful family of God, and that with that membership, that belonging to that family, that they can accomplish anything, and that they need to. Where much is given, much is required, and my father said that to us all the time. Where much is given, much is required.
In 2020, we sat down once more with Anne to find out what she'd been up to in the last 6 years since we had spoken. Alyssa James from Utah Women's Walk Board conducted this interview. A warning to listeners, the following contains mention of sexual violence.
Well, since you've last been interviewed, it's been a few years, and I just want you to tell us about some more things that you've been doing and maybe some more valuable experiences that you'd like to share.
Well, thanks. I think that most of my life has been busy with Big Ocean Women. We train women to lead by recognizing their innate, inherent feminine gifts. And they lead first with their family, and then they expand to lead in the community. And at times, this leadership even extends to our global sisters and brothers all over the world. It's exciting. It's wonderful. The girl that started this organization, her name is Carolina Allen, and just kind of had an epiphany about her role in the world and how she could make a difference. And so she had some really profound experiences that helped her see this innate power within women, and she had a burning drive to help other women recognize that herself. And so she started an organization called Big Ocean Women. And when I went to the first meeting to support her as the daughter of my good close friend, my first thought was, you've got to change the name of this organization. No one's going to want to join an organization called Big Ocean Women. And my husband has teased me, you know, what are you big women doing tonight? You know, but turns out that the name is exactly what it needs to be. She saw herself as just a tiny little wave, but when she lifted her eyes, she could see that she was really part of a big ocean, and that the majority of women in the world feel like she does, in that she honors her feminine identity. She honors her womanhood. She honors and rejoices in the role of creating life and nurturing and influencing young lives to be the best they can be. And so it's a great name. Our mantra, and I'm sure that you would agree, is that every woman is a creator and that every woman should have a voice. Our mission is that we envision a world where all women are valued and create positive, generative solutions, solutions that benefit the coming generations. We have cottages all over the world, and recently we've been able to partner a domestic here in the United States cottage with an international cottage. So, for example, Spanish for cottage is a sister cottage to the Ghana cottage. The Houston cottage is a sister cottage to the Nigeria Jos cottage. So those relationships are very meaningful. We help one another. We learn from one another. When we see the impact that our cottage members are having in their own families, in their communities, and then the broader outreach, it's really rewarding.
What kind of projects have you done?
Well, recently, of course, with the pandemic, we have been able to ask ourselves and our friends to be generous, and we've been able to help people, our cottage members, and also other people in really significant ways. For example, posted that we were going to try to help the Navajo Nation. And within days, we had thousands of dollars come in. And with that money, we rented a 26-foot trailer, filled it to the brim. People were so generous. And Carolina and her husband Ashley took a little trip and drove it to the reservation and unloaded it there. We received word from our South Sudan cottage leader that they needed money for locks. Because of the pandemic, these young boys were breaking into homes and holding the mother at gunpoint and taking the young girls out on the street and gang raping them. So they needed money for locks, so that they could protect their families. So of course we did that, and we asked them to itemize, you know, their project. We wanted to know, you know, some specifics. In that plan, though, there were construction materials. And so when I questioned her about the construction materials, she says, well, that's for the woman with the 8-year-old daughter who was taken out into the street. And then it hit me. That woman didn't have a door. She didn't have a wall. So that kind of aid has been really sweet to give. Our Nigerian cottage, the people, because of the pandemic, were in lockdown. They couldn't go out to work, sell their goods. They live day by day. If they can't go out to work today, they don't have any food for tomorrow. And so we were able to send money that our generous donors had given us.
What do you feel is critical, most important right now for us to focus on or develop in our lives during these turbulent times?
Well, one thing that I've come to more fully understand through Big Ocean Women is the model of powerful impact, that you have influenced me, you've impacted my life. You even use that word impact by just the connection that we have. But every woman has that power within her. Every woman is innately gifted to influence. And there's nothing more important than that power to influence. It begins with the closest people around you, and then it extends wider and wider. But it comes from within. It's not a power that we receive from somebody else, as far as an organization or a government, or even, you know, even monetary wealth. It's something internal, and we all have it. And if we recognize and follow the right source when we're using that power, we can do great things. And for me, that source, of course, is God. And I see the gift that He's given me, the power and the strength and the experiences, the people I connect with, all of that as a vehicle to do good, to do His work. And I think that in times of uncertainty, if we tap into that power, we feel that we realize how abundant our life is, just innately, not because of where we live or what we're doing, but just that innate core feeling of abundance and being blessed helps us to be generous and to be influential to others. So I say shine on, use that power, use that strength, and recognize your source.
We thank Ann Takasaki for both of her interviews. She is a woman who leaves a legacy of hard work, dedication, and service to home, church, and family. If you would like to learn more about the Big Ocean Women Project, you can visit bigoceanwomen.org. If you've enjoyed today's episode, be sure to share it with a friend, as well as subscribe and rate us on iTunes. You can access the full interviews with Ann Takasaki and many others on our website, utahwomenswalk.org. You can also visit the Utah Women's Walk exhibit, where the monumental statue Connection by artist Ben Hammond is on display at Thanksgiving Point Gardens in Lehi, Utah. A special thanks to our producer and writer, Tamara Kemsley, and our editor, Ron Kuhl, as well as Catherine McIntyre and Richard McLean from the George Sutherland Archives at Utah Valley University. And a special thanks to our supporters, Denise and Ellen Alexander, Julie Bagley, and Shauna Duke. Thanks again for listening to today's episode of Legacies.